I'm Bella Johnson, medical intuitive and host of Alternative Currents. Alternative Currents is heard the first Friday of every month at 10 a.m. Join me as we explore together the world of the seen and unseen as they relate to one another, to our health, and the well-being of our local and global communities. That's Alternative Currents, aired on the first Friday of every month at 10 a.m., only on this, your community radio station, WERU-FM Blue Hill, 89.9 and 102.9 Bangor.
Support for public affairs programming on WERU comes from Coastal Enterprises Incorporated, CEI, a private nonprofit community development organization offering financing and technical assistance to small businesses, social service facilities, and affordable housing projects throughout Maine. 882-7552.
The time is 10 o'clock. Stay tuned for Alternative Currents with Bella Johnson.
Good morning, and welcome to Alternative Currents. I'm Bella Johnson, your host. And today's show airs a pre-recorded interview, and so we will not be taking call-ins during the second half of the program. But I hope you enjoy today's broadcast, sure you will, and look forward to your comments and input on next month's show. Every so often, Putnam Publishing sends me a newly released book in the alternative health field. One of these books was A Guidance from the Darkness, The Transforming Power of the Divine Feminine in Difficult Times. Not only did the title pique my interest due to the intensity of the times we are currently living in with such huge potentiality for human growth and evolution, but when I started reading it, I knew it would be something of interest to you listeners. The author, Reverend Mary Murray Shelton, received her ministerial training at Holmes Institute in Seattle. Residing in the San Francisco area, she is a founding member of the Sacred Arts Council and an instructor at the Holmes Institute School of Ministry. I am delighted that I've reached her for an interview before she sets out on tour as she leads women's workshops and speaks to organizations and at conferences across the country. So I would like to welcome her to our show today and let her talk about her book, Guidance from the Darkness, The Transforming Power of the Divine Feminine in Difficult Times. Good morning, Mary.
Good morning, Bella. Thank you so much for having me on your show.
Thank you for being available.
My pleasure.
Can you explain to our listeners what motivated you to write this book and generally what it's about, and we'll go from there.
Sure. I have been a minister in two large congregations, and in working with congregants during difficult times, I've been really inspired by some of them who have made the uncommon choice in the midst of their darkness to follow their intuitive guidance or their inner knowing instead of their habit in responding to the situation. And what I mean by that is that all of us have kind of a reaction immediately when a difficulty hits in our lives. It varies from person to person, but generally we react according to our habit. So we might be fearful and run away. We might attack the situation or the people involved. We might sort of play dead. We all have our ways of reacting. But in some situations, I've seen people really turn to their spiritual knowing and ask what to do, and respond by following that instead of the habitual type of response. And it is inspiring to me the kinds of results that people have had when they choose to do that. It's challenging to do. It's easier to follow our habit and react automatically. And even after we do that, we still have the choice to listen to the guidance. So the book originally began because I wanted to share some of their stories and talk about what's more possible for us in terms of responding to challenges. However, once I started writing the book, I actually got plunged into a dark time of my own, and I had to step out of my ministry in Southern California because I was in so much back pain that I could barely walk. So a lot of the book got written really during my recovery period while I was dealing with all this physical pain of my own. So some of my stories are also in the book, and then the second half of the book is tools. I call them qualities of being, tools that we can use to help us when we're in the midst of a challenge, whether it's large or small, to come back to center and be more available to our inner guidance than we might ordinarily be on an everyday basis. So that's how the book began, and darkness, everybody experiences it. The divine feminine, sometimes people ask why I put that in the title. Does that mean that I think only women have these qualities, or I think that God is female? And the answer to both those questions is no. I say the transforming power of the divine feminine in the title because in the West, we're so linear that we identify both ourselves and God with most of the very linear qualities. So in most of the world's religions, we identify God as the king, the lawgiver, the dispenser of reward and punishment. And we see ourselves in the West as very goal-oriented, very sequential, very logical. And while those qualities, I think, are very real and valuable, both in God and in us, I think there's more. I think there's a side of the divine and a side of ourselves that we overlook, which is the spontaneous and holistic and nonlinear and simultaneous rather than sequential, the mystery, if you will. And that's what I'm referring to as the divine feminine. So it's something I believe all of us have, and I want to bring it to the forefront of our awareness, particularly during these times of amazingly rapid change, so that we have more resources to rely upon than just the intellect. So that's really, in a nutshell, how the book came to be and what some of it is about.
Do you consider it a synchronicity that you yourself got plunged into this dark night of the soul when you decided to write this book?
Oh, absolutely. When I first started in the ministry, I discovered that in planning my Sunday talk titles, I needed to give them to our newsletter editor about a month in advance. So I would have to create the titles before I had done a lot of work on the talks. So I had to kind of intuitively come up with the titles and then work on them as the talks came up. And what I discovered was that every time I had a talk coming up in the upcoming week, I got to live the theme of whatever I called it for that whole week. So I had had that experience before in brief with talk titles, but I didn't know it worked that way with books. And so I wasn't expecting to go into the darkness myself. I was expecting to be looking at it from the outside.
Sure.
It certainly took the writing to a much deeper level. And I think it was very valuable as a contributor to the book, although it was certainly difficult for me at the time.
So I'm thinking of Rabbi Kushner's book about how bad things happen to good people. And looking at the inner leaf of your book and saying, yes, despite our best wishes to the contrary, bad things can happen to good people. Can you comment on this?
Oh, yeah. I think that darkness is such a universal human experience. We tend to think that if we're really good and we get it just right, that we won't have extremely difficult challenges in our lives. We get the idea sometimes that because our consciousness is so creative, that we can actually avoid having any challenging experiences. I don't really think that we're on the planet to avoid being challenged. I don't think challenges are a bad thing for us, although they can be painful for us sometimes. So I think when we look at the whole spectrum of life, from saints to people who are really struggling with finding the way in their lives, we see that everybody experiences challenge, but not all of us respond to it in the same way. And I think that our response is so incredibly powerful in terms of how we experience what we're going through. And we have a tremendous amount of choice and power around how we respond to what comes in our lives. So to whatever degree we've contributed to bringing those experiences into our lives, the important moment then becomes, how do we choose to respond to the challenges in our lives, whether we have awareness of how we've drawn those things to us or not? And we can respond in ways that empower us and give us what I call more elbow room around the challenges, or we can respond in ways that really box us in. For example, this is a simple example. You have two people who have gone through relationship breakups. One of them might say, I can't believe I did this again. I'm so lousy at relationships. Nobody's ever going to love me. I don't know why I keep trying. That's one reaction to the situation. Another person might respond by saying, I see that I'm doing the same thing that I've done before. What do I need to do to find a new response so that I don't keep creating the same situation in relationships over and over again? How can I learn to do this differently so that I can make better choices, so that I can respond better to my partner, so I can be a more loving person? I think that that second response gives the person a lot more elbow room around how they deal with the challenge of a breakup in their lives than the first kind of reaction.
And I like the way you put those questions as well, where you're asking, what do I need to do and how can I respond better? It's almost in the humanistic psychology tradition, these are the questions that replace the word why.
Yes. And why is really not always a helpful question to ask because there isn't generally an answer that we can put our fingers on. So while we're curious and we'd like to know why, even if we had the answer in itself doesn't necessarily empower us to make the change.
Right.
So when we're looking at something that's not working in our lives, to assume that there's no way to impact it is a very disempowering point of view. And I think that in most cases, there is something we can do that, if it doesn't change the circumstances, can change us. And that change in us can give us the elbow room around the circumstances that we need to live our lives in a more balanced, happy way than to look upon it as a disaster that we'll never get over.
And that's part of free will, too, isn't it? I often say sometimes it seems like we have no free will, but in fact, the free will comes in, for me anyway, when we have the choice, when we decide to act on the choice.
Yes, and the choice of response is always ours. So no matter how difficult our circumstances are, the choice of how we respond really ultimately is no one's but ours. And no matter what another person wants from us or does in the circumstance, they can't force a response from us. It's always up to us. So even if we have a very entrenched habit of reacting in a particular way and somebody knows that, there are still times when we can say, no, I'm not going to do that this time. I'm not going down that road. I'm making a new choice. If it weren't possible for us to do that, human beings would never grow and learn, and we see ample evidence that we do all around us. So what I'm trying to do with Guidance from the Darkness is really encourage people to think outside the box, to give themselves more possibilities, to realize that they always have some additional choices. It may not be easy to make those choices that are outside our habit. We do feel like we're swimming upstream for a while when we're creating a new habit, but we can certainly do it. We all have it within us to do it.
Don't you think a key point, too, is affirming that you do want to make that change, even if it means, yes, you're thinking, I'd like to get out of the box, but even speaking that intention?
Yes. I think it's wonderful just to be able to recognize that there is another possibility, and even though we don't know how to do it, we want to make some kind of a step toward it or some kind of a commitment to it, because that in itself can begin to draw to us the ideas and the people and the resources and the information that we need to make that change, and the strength that we need to make that change. So I've used the first half of the book to talk about universal challenges that all of us experience: change, fear, anger, loss, or what I call in the book brokenness, and death. Everybody experiences them. So I tell stories of various people going through those challenges and extrapolate from what they did, you know, what their choices were. But in the second half of the book, I really get down to talking about the qualities of being, what I call qualities of being, the action tools that we can take and the thinking tools that we can use to help us when we find ourselves in the midst of challenges. And, you know, somebody was asking me the other day what my idea of darkness is. What do I mean by darkness? And I said, you know, darkness is everything from walking into the bank and seeing really long lines when you're in a hurry and knowing you're going to have to stand there, to losing a partner or a spouse or a child, all of those experiences from irritation to deepest grief are shades of challenge and darkness that we experience in our lives. And certainly, there are varying degrees of effectiveness with how we respond to those that can bring us more peace or less peace.
And don't you know that you're speaking to a culture that doesn't do grief or death?
I know.
So it's great that you're approaching these.
It's ironic because we experience so much change in our culture. I was reading Peter Russell's, the re-release of his book, A White Hole in Time. The re-release is called Waking Up in Time. And in it, he says that we now experience more change in 1 year than the pharaohs did in 100 years. So if we could imagine that the changes we experience in our lifetime used to occur over 5 generations, it's no wonder that we're confused and overwhelmed some of the time. So since change is not only inevitable and constant and so massive in our lives, it's ironic that we do live in a culture that's so resistant to aging and challenge and death and all of those things that are simply a part of the process. So everything that we can do to assist us to respond to change with more balance, I think is really helpful to be able to look into and practice.
And I like the title of this chapter, Change is a Process, Not an Event. Can you speak to that briefly?
Yes. I have addressed in the chapter on change what I call a sequence of unfoldment. There's an event, perhaps, or a series of events that may happen in our lives that change our life. So our life is going along in one direction and we have a parent die, or we change jobs, or we have a baby, or we move to a new city or country. An event happens, or some sequence of events happens, and life changes, but that's not the end of it. We then go through a whole internal process that follows that event, and often the first unfoldment is grief. And if people are making a change that they've been looking forward to, they cannot figure out oftentimes why they feel so ambivalent about the change. I've always wanted this job, I should be happy. Or I finally had this baby, why am I feeling so mixed in my feelings? Or I've always wanted to live in this city, and now I feel so confused and upset all the time. The reason, in my mind, is that we are experiencing a loss of the familiar. And even if the familiar wasn't ideal for us, it was comfortable, and we knew what to do with it. So when we shift into a change, even when it's one we've really wanted, we lose the familiar for a while. And so it isn't unusual for people to go into a kind of a grief process where they feel confused and ambivalent for a while. It doesn't mean there's anything wrong with them. It doesn't mean there's anything wrong with the change that they're experiencing or that they made the wrong decision. It's just a part of the process of change. And when people go through a serious loss and they have deep grief, then for a while, the universe and life starts to beckon to them to come back and rejoin life. And as soon as they notice that, I consider that the next unfoldment in the change process, the awareness that life is still going on. When we're plunged into grief for a while, we lose track of that. And when we begin to be aware that life is still going on and it's beckoning to us, sometimes we're not very welcoming of the encouragement of life to come back at the beginning because we feel like we're not finished grieving. So there is another unfoldment that follows that awareness, which is willingness, when we have both the awareness that life is going on and we start to get interested in it again. And then following that, we take action, which is the next unfoldment. We actually step back into the stream of life. And usually at that point, we think, okay, I'm back. This is it. Life is good. It's going to be fine. And so it may surprise us that another unfoldment hits after that, which is struggle. Not everybody experiences this, but often when we're trying to grasp the new life and we're leaving the old life behind, there's a gap in the middle of adjusting where we aren't who we were and the old life isn't there anymore. We aren't yet who we are becoming and we haven't entirely grasped the new life yet. And so we take action toward that new life and we hit the struggle of trying to now find the new doctor and the new dentist and the new grocery store in the new town or whatever it might be. And it takes a little while until life begins to feel more balanced again, and then we come into the last unfoldment, which I call small T transformation. So we go from the change itself, the event, through grief and awareness, willingness, action, struggle, and then transformation back into this dream of life and having it feel more familiar and comfortable to us again. It isn't just the change event itself. It's the whole process, and we can do these things not necessarily in that sequence, too. Sometimes we do some of them simultaneously, but they are elements of coming through a change.
Okay, I think I'd like to take a small break and do a station ID, and then mm-hmm. we'll come back and talk to Mary Murray Shelton, Reverend Mary Murray Shelton again. We are on Alternative Currents today, talking about Reverend Shelton's book, Guidance from the Darkness, The Transforming Power of the Divine Feminine in Difficult Times. This is WERU-FM Blue Hill, 89.9 and 102.9 in Bangor. We'll be returning in just a moment. Listening to wonderful Alex DeGrassi's Slow Circle in Burness is the cut from that CD. I don't know if I've ever told you that on the show in 2 years. We're back on Alternative Currents, Bella Johnson, your host, and speaking to Reverend Mary Murray Shelton, author of Guidance from the Darkness, The Transforming Power of the Divine Feminine in Difficult Times, available from Putnam Publishing. Welcome back, Mary.
Thank you.
So we were talking about, what I'd call the process versus the destination.
Yes.
Certainly, in many ways, a feminine way of looking at things. If we're talking about the divine feminine, a circle versus a line.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you had mentioned in your second half of your book you were giving some tools to deal with some of these things. Are we ready to talk about that, or do we need to expand on the first half a little bit more?
No, I think this is a good time to talk about the qualities of being. They're really I was trying to figure out when I was writing the book what to call these. They're the tools that I kept finding myself coming back to again and again when I was recovering from my back problem. And somebody in California at a book signing asked me why there were 8. He said, couldn't there be 12 or 15? I said, I'm sure there are. I'm sure there are more. The reason there are 8 is because these are my 8. They're the ones that I can talk about. They're the ones that I experience over and over again. So it isn't that I think they're any more spiritual. They're just mine. And the 8 are attention, intention, choice, practice, surrender, which is not the same thing as giving up, intuition, gratitude, and trust. And what I discovered about these is in order for me to practice any one of them effectively, I have to let go of some habit of thinking and behaving that I would normally gravitate toward. So in the book, I use the metaphor that if you could imagine you were in the darkness looking for the light, for a way back to home and center, and you saw a passageway with light at the end of it and thought to yourself, that's the way I'm going to go. And when you got to the entrance of the passageway, there's a big angel standing there who says, I'm going to give you a tool to use that will help you get through this passageway back to the light. But in order to use the tool, you have to leave something here. You have to leave something behind. So for each one of these, I find there's something I have to let go of in order to take hold of it and practice it. For example, the quality of being of practice. What I get if I practice anything, which means that I repeat it regularly, is eventual mastery. So the process of practice will lead me to mastery, but in order to do it effectively, I have to let go of my desire for instant results, and I have to let go of my tendency to quit when it's not going my way. So I have to set those two things aside, or we all would have to, in order just to do the practice, whether the practice is taking a deep breath when I'm frustrated, or meditation, or going for an exercise period each day, in order to keep up the repetition and the rhythm of the practice to lead me to mastery, I have to let go of those other two things. So for each one of the qualities of being, in order to practice it at all, there's something I have to set aside, and there is something that I gain from practicing it. And so I see these tools being used in spiritual traditions all over the world, not necessarily with these same names. And I see them in the congregants whose stories I tell in the book, things that they have chosen to do that are different than their habits. So they had to leave something of their habit behind in order to make the choice. And then they gained something by doing that. So the qualities of being are ways of paying attention to what we're experiencing and action responses that allow us, as I said earlier, a little bit more elbow room around the situation that we find ourselves in. For example, there's a fellow that came to guest speak at our church when I was in Southern California during the midst of my dark time, named Mitchell, W. Mitchell. He's a fellow who was both burned in a serious motorcycle accident as a young man and was in an accident flying his own private plane, so he's now paraplegic in addition to being burned. And after he was burned, after he was burned, he started a business that made him a multimillionaire. And after that was the accident that made him a paraplegic, and following that he became mayor of a small town in Colorado. And now he travels all over the country and talks to people about human possibilities. So when I heard him speak was during a time when I was in pretty extreme back pain and I was sitting propped up in the audience on pillows. And I had a really hard time feeling sorry for myself sitting there looking at him and listening to him talk. And he told the audience, in referring to himself, "I used to be able to do 10,000 things. Now I can only do 9,000 things. I prefer to put my attention on the 9,000 things I can do rather than on the 1,000 things I can't do." That, to me, is really a practice of attention and choice. And in order to do that, he has to let go of thinking of himself as a victim. He has to let go of obsessing over what happened to him in the past or worrying about what might happen in the future in order to practice choice and attention. And he really is a master of it because the circumstances that plunged him into the darkness really have not changed. But he is not in the darkness anymore. And that, I think, is really key. For many of us, our circumstances will shift and change. But even if they don't, our experience of being in the darkness is not dependent upon the circumstances. It's dependent upon us.
Now, I just want to briefly touch on anger, chapter 3 in your book, Anger, mm-hmm. Friend or Enemy, because when something like this happens, and certainly to him it happened two major times in his life, and I'm sure a lot of minor times, a lot of people would respond with anger.
Oh, yes, and I'm sure he was angry. I think that anger is not an unusual first reaction for us to have. I don't think that our first response is really the important one. I think it's the second response. So anger may be something that comes up for us periodically while we're dealing with a frustration or a challenge. I don't mean to suggest that we'll all be so saintly that we won't be fearful or grief-stricken or angry in the process of going through our challenges, but that there is more beyond the anger. And anger can become a box we can get stuck in. And at a certain point, the energy that it gives us, which could propel us forward into greater choices, can start to feed on itself and actually victimize us further. So, great, if you're angry, be angry, slam doors, write letters you're not going to mail, get that energy moving, get it up and out, and then see what kind of choice you can make next. And if the anger comes back, go do it all again. I used to get in my car on the freeway when I was commuting to work, if I was going through an angry time like that, and just yell and scream in my car. Now, it can't unnerve people near you on the freeway, but it's effective in terms of doing it privately and not taking a gun out to those people on the freeway, which is sometimes the way that anger is getting expressed these days.
Well, luckily, where we are, we have a lot of quiet country roads.
Isn't that great?
So, gives us a little better better avenue that way, though.
I think we do need to express our anger. I don't think that pushing it down or pretending we don't have it is a healthy response for us. But I do think we require healthy outlets for our anger. So in our culture, it tends to be difficult for many women to express their anger. And that doesn't mean we don't have it. So we need to find ways that we can express it where we don't feel we're going to hurt ourselves or somebody else, but we can still get that energy up to the surface and moving on out.
And certainly you say women have the challenge, but I also see it with men just being afraid of what that energy may do to others.
Yes. It's an interesting thing culturally that we often have women who have been trained not to express anger and men who've been trained not to express sadness or grief. That's not always true. And in fact, nowadays it's less true than it used to be. But there still is that tendency sometimes. And we need both sides. We need to be able to feel and express both sides. So men don't need to be immobilized by sadness or grief any more than women do. But they can be immobilized by it when they don't realize that they're going through a grief process because they've been trained not to acknowledge it or not to recognize it.
Well, I've often said anger is a motivator, and if we can harness the energy that we feel rattling around inside of us and in some way focus it and move it out, that's the catalyst for change.
It certainly has been in so many cases where people have started organizations and foundations that were based on something that happened that upset them and made them so angry they felt something needed to be done and they didn't see it being done, so they started it themselves. I do think, though, that if the motivation remains anger, then ultimately what we create starts to unravel itself or starts to do more damage than good. So it is important that we let anger be a motivator and not an ongoing process in and of itself, I think.
Right. I'm going to get back to these steps, Mary, the steps that you take, the attention, intention, choice, practice, surrender, intuition, gratitude, and trust, and have you address those a little bit more. I fear of running out of time because this information is so valuable, so I want to get you kind of back there if we can.
Sure, thanks. Let's see. Let me talk about attention for a moment in a little bit more depth than I did just a second ago in referring to Mitchell's process. When we go through a change in our lives, often we want to get life back the way it was before. So our mind keeps going back to what happened. What could I have done differently? How can I make them love me again? How can I get my job back? How can I make it the way it was before? But usually once a change happens, life isn't going to be the way it was before. So when we obsess about the past, we really can't change the past. And when we become anxious about what might happen to us in the future, the point of power is not in the future. The point of power is always right now. The choices that we make in the moment right now, what we decide we will think about it, what we decide we will do about it right now. So the quality of being of attention is bringing attention to the present moment. So we let go in the moment of being stuck on the past or the future. We bring our attention to this present moment. And the result is that we gain the actual power to make a difference in our experience, in the now moment. And there is tremendous power in recognizing the now moment. It also is the place where we feel the pain that we're going through. Sometimes we cast ourselves into the past to better days or fantasizing about the future so that we won't have to feel the present moment. But unless we feel the present moment, we can't impact it positively to shift it or make a change or become more effective in the midst of it. So the first quality of being of attention revolves around that. The second quality of being of intention, what I mean when I use the word intention is that we have our vision focused on the goal we would like to see, but focused softly, So in a sense, we're committed to the goal, but we're willing to let divine rewrites or cosmic left turns come into the process, is what I call them. Rarely do I see us with a dream or a vision or a goal where we lay out our plan, we work our plan, and everything goes according to plan, and we march right straight down and achieve the goal. Almost always, the monkey wrench gets thrown in, and we have what I call a cosmic left turn, where we think we're now moving away from the goal. Like, how did this happen? How did I get over here? Intention says that I keep my vision on the outcome that I'm working toward, but I am loose about the how. I let the universe bring resources to me and help direct the course of it. Because sometimes I need to move slightly off the direct path in order to gather information or skills or people that I need to get to the end result that I didn't even know that I needed. So in order to practice, I have to realize that my path may shift on the way to that goal. And in fact, that in what I learn along that path, my perception of the goal might shift too. So in order for me to practice intention, I have to let go of my absolute grip on wanting to have a guaranteed outcome that's totally predictable, that will look exactly like what I first envisioned. I have to let go of the guaranteed outcome in order to get unlimited possibilities, which is what the practice of intention can bring us. So, for example, if I have lost my job, and what I want is to get a job where I'll feel fulfilled, and in my mind that means it's going to be exactly like my old job, then I have a very small vision, and I'm saying to the universe, the only possibilities I want to enter into this job search are those that will bring me a job exactly like my old one. Whereas if instead I hold to the vision that what I want is simply a job that's really fulfilling for me, I may discover that the universe takes me in a direction of much larger possibilities that I could not have imagined, into a work life that I didn't envision before, but that brings me the experience that I wanted. So that would be the way that I would use the quality of intention in the midst of a challenge like a job change to find a larger circle of possibilities than I would have just by hanging on to my narrow view of what the outcome had to be. Does this make sense?
It makes perfect sense. I would just ask if you could, address refining one's intentions through getting clearer. Sometimes we think we know what we want, and then as time goes by, we say, oh, we want this, but, you know, this would really be a much more focused way of letting that intention be known. It's not a way of controlling it. It's a way of refining the intention. In other words, we say, okay, I want a new job. Let's give an example here. And I just don't think it does any harm, and sometimes can help by saying, I want a job where I can use my creativity. I want a job that I don't have to leave my family to
pursue. Yes.
So yes. On the subject of refining intentions, what are your thoughts on that?
I think that when we begin to look at what it is we want, it's very helpful for us to consider how we want to feel when we're experiencing it. Now, this may be easier for some of the women listeners to understand than the guys.
It's that process of integration.
Oftentimes you ask a guy, how do you feel about your job? And he'll say, I feel fine. Like, what are you talking about? What I mean is identify, do I want to feel challenged? Do I want to feel fulfilled? Do I want to feel peaceful and harmonious with my coworkers? There are a lot of different ways that people can enjoy their work in terms of the experience of it. So if we're talking about work as an example, it's very helpful if people identify what the qualities are that they want to experience in the work first, before they start trying to nail down what the specific work is or what the actual work day has to look like. Because sometimes, as we get clearer about what the experience is that we want, we'll be led in the directions that we need to go to have that experience, and it may not look in form like what we expected. I think it's also helpful, as you were saying, for us to define what the edges are for us. For example, if we really do not want to have a long commute because we want to be with our family, then that becomes a very important piece of what we're looking at. And it is a parameter that we don't want to compromise or let go of in the process. And those will tend to reveal themselves as we get clearer about what we want that work experience to be. Well, I want to have a harmonious, peaceful experience at work and with my family life, so I don't want to be gone from my family nights and weekends, or maybe I don't want to be gone from my family 12 hours a day, or, you know, whatever it might be for that particular individual. As we go along, more information reveals itself to us, and we think, you know, I thought I wanted to work in an outdoor environment, but that's not really true. What I want is I want to work in an environment where I can see the outdoors around me in the workspace, but I don't actually want to be out in it. So as an example, sometimes when we begin to refine what we want to experience, we discover more about what's really true for us than we knew at the beginning of the process.
Right.
And that can be very important in helping us find a happy situation.
So moving to choice.
Choice, yes. We get a lot of support culturally to be victims. And while it's great to get the support and the comfort and the attention initially when something devastating has happened to us, in the long run, if we stay in that place, it really begins to weaken us. The attention that we get is from people who see us as weakened, and we begin to develop that view of ourselves as well. So I think that we can, this is an example of how we use choice. We can see ourselves as someone who has experienced being victimized rather than taking on the identification as a victim. And there's a lot of power in that distinction, in making that choice, because if I'm a victim, that's my identity. If I'm a person who's experienced victimization, it's an experience rather than my identity, and I have a lot more elbow room around what to do next. If I'm a victim, I'm looking to other people to get me through it, to get me justice, whatever it might be. If I'm a person who has been victimized, then I can choose to participate in the process that I need to go forward in for the best outcome for me. I am more empowered and I have more choices around it. So even knowing that we have a choice can make a big difference in our perception of ourselves and how much power we have. I tell a story in my book, Guidance from the Darkness, that originally came from the introduction to In Search of Excellence that Tom Peters wrote. And in the introduction to the book, there's a description of a test, I guess you would call it, that was given to two groups of people where they had to add up a large complex column of figures in a room that was filled with noise, and I believe it was taped noise that was piped in. So what both groups were hearing was a jackhammer and a bunch of kids yelling and people talking to each other in a number of different languages, just a lot of chaos and noise. And one group had a button that they could push to turn the noise off. And when they assessed the two groups afterwards, the group with the button, as we might expect, were much more accurate in adding up their columns of figures. But the kicker is they never used the button. None of them ever used it. It was knowing that they had a choice, the point of view that they had a choice that would impact their circumstances. The point of view itself made the difference, even though they didn't exercise the choice. And the reason I tell that story is because it's very subtle, our ability to select the point of view that I do have a choice, as compared to selecting the point of view that I do not have a choice. Even if I don't exercise the choice, assuming that I have one, can make me more effective in the midst of whatever the process is I'm going through than assuming that I do not have a choice. So choice is powerful, and the awareness of choice is powerful. And the choice to believe I have a choice is powerful, if that doesn't sound too confusing.
Not at all. This is beautiful. Practice.
Practice, I spoke to a little bit earlier. Practice is anything that we do repeatedly. And practice is an amazing thing. The brain is designed to respond to repetition. So when we repeat anything over and over again, the way that the neurons fire in the brain is along what we call a pathway. so that there's actually a groove that's sort of formed by the repetition of those neurons firing over and over again. So just like a pathway through a field, as that pathway gets more and more defined, it gets easier and easier to walk through the field. So it is in the brain that as we do something over and over again, the pathway is formed in the brain and the neurons fire more and more quickly along the pathway. So it becomes easier and easier to do that. That's how our habits are formed, in a sense. Our brain supports the formation of habits. The interesting thing is that this is true with thoughts as well as with action. So just as we learn to drive a car or we learn to dance or we learn to smoke, so we learn to think certain things. And the more we think a thought, the easier it is to think it over and over again. So we can get into habits of putting ourselves down that we repeat almost unconsciously because we've thought them so often that the brain does it for us automatically. The good news is that just as we can change a physical habit, we can also change a thought habit. And at first, it's difficult because we're walking a new path, so we sort of have to get the mental machete out and get the weeds out of the way to walk that path the first few times. But the more we walk it, the more it becomes an easy path to walk. And the more we abandon the old path, the more overgrown it becomes, just as it would out in a field of grass. So the repetition itself begins to make a difference for us, even if we're not sure we entirely believe the new thought we're trying to cultivate for ourselves, or we're not sure we entirely believe we can really accomplish this new action we're trying to practice or this new exercise that we're trying to do. Repetition will make it easier to do in both cases. The other thing that's magic about the brain is that it doesn't really know the difference between an actual experience and something that we vividly imagine. So we can do mental rehearsals for things, whether it be conversations or physical activities. You know, an American just won a gold medal in diving who had broken her foot. I can't remember her name right now.
I can't either. I just watched that, too.
And she did mental rehearsals. Now, when she came into this competition, I think she was seventh or eighth, and she wound up with a gold medal. She's the only one of the athletes that I know of that they spoke about who did visualizations or mental rehearsals.
Yeah, they called it positive thinking,
yeah.
The way that they put it out on the network.
It. Right. But it is the brain will support that. So if we know that, we can practice in a number of ways that will help move us toward a greater sense of comfort or ease or peacefulness. So, for example, if I have a tendency to criticize a child in my family, and in my mind I'm always thinking, that kid never listens, he's so irresponsible, when is he going to get it? And I think that way about him every day, I will cultivate my view of him as that, and I will tend to miss other qualities of his while I'm busy cultivating that view. Whereas if I decide I'm not going to indulge in that kind of thinking about this child anymore, instead, I'm going to be vigilant to look for the times that he remembers to do things and thank him.
I'm just
going to shift my practice to that instead. And that can be very empowering not only to the parent, but for the child.
I totally agree with you on this. I'm thinking of an example in my own life where I used to really wonder about humanity and how people could do such horrible things and these kinds of things, and shifted my perception to people really basically want to help one another. And it really opened up a whole new vista, because now I really see that people basically want to help one another. So
yeah.
Whether that's positive reinforcement or whatever it's called, it certainly has made a major shift in my perceptions of
yes.
human beings.
And I'm not sure, Bella, that the perception people are terrible to each other is a more realistic perception than the perception that people want to help each other. You know, sometimes we get the impression that one thing is more realistic than another, but I don't believe that's true at all. I think it's just our habit of the point of view that we take, what reveals itself to us and reinforces our view. So the point of view we choose is really important to the world we want to experience and cultivate.
Right. Can you speak briefly to age and habit? In other words, we talk about changing thoughts and changing actions and changing ways of perceiving things. Do you think age has an impact on that? getting
older?
I don't think
age has an impact on it in terms of our ability to do it. I think age can have an impact on it in terms of our cultural belief that it's harder for us to change when we've done something for a longer period of time or when we're older. When my mother was alive, she used to refer to older people as being set in their ways, like they can't change now because they're set in their ways. But just because we've done something for a long time doesn't mean we can't make a change in it if we see that we would like our life to be different. So I don't think, you know, there are studies now that show that older people who begin an exercise program, a physical exercise program, their muscles are just as responsive to the exercise as they are for somebody who's young. They used to think that, you know, people who were older, their muscles didn't respond as well, but that appears to not be true. So if you decide you're going to use something that you've never used before or you haven't used in a very long time, that really doesn't mean that it isn't there for you anymore or you can't do it. And I want to encourage people, whatever their age is, to consider the possibility that they can change their point of view about things or their habit about things or their practice about things if they're simply willing to keep reminding themselves and persist. All of us can do that. We find young people who are just as intractable as any old person might possibly be. I don't think age is the factor that makes all the difference unless we think it is.
Right. Perceive it to be.
Yes.
Surrender.
Surrender. Surrender is a beautiful quality. It's not about giving up, which is a sense of hopelessness. Surrender is about letting go of thinking that it has to be a certain way, that I have to be right about it, that I have to fit it into a box and judge it in a certain way. Surrender is letting go of that and allowing the situation to unfold, allowing it to reveal itself to me, in a sense, keeping an open mind about what's happening so that I am more able to perceive the whole process instead of latching onto my point of view about it and then only seeing it from that perspective. So the other day I challenged a group of people I was giving a talk to look at their own ability to be flexible and shift in their point of view by selecting a political opinion they have right now that they have a very strong opinion about, because we're certainly in a political climate right now with the elections coming up, to consider something they have a very strong point of view about it and to actually force themselves to look at it from the other side, from the other point of view, and to look at it from that side with the intention of finding what the benefits and blessings are of going about it from the other direction. Not because they need to change their opinion or their point of view at all, but because it gives them a more whole view of what the situation and circumstances might bring. And in a way, one has to surrender, then, one's attachment to their own opinion. You know, Ram Dass said a couple of years ago, I still have as many opinions as I had when I was younger. I just don't take them as seriously anymore. And I thought that was a great statement. I aspire to not take my own opinions so seriously anymore, to recognize that they're opinions. They're not the truth. So in a sense, surrender allows us to open to a broader view, to take ourselves and other people out of boxes that we've placed ourselves in, and to see the human being in a larger perspective. So if I view a Democrat as wasteful spendthrifts, who want a controlling government, or if I view Republicans as selfish industrialists who only want to make a lot of money for themselves, I'm missing the total view. And what I'll do is I'll continue to gather evidence that supports my point of view, that substantiates my belief that, yep, this defines that group of people. But then I never see the people. In order to see the whole picture, I have to surrender my attachment to that view and my judgment. Ironically, when I let go of my need to be right all the time and be right about my judgments about everything, what I get is a greater sense of safety, because I'm not creating enemies and I'm not creating bad people and bad situations out there. I'm seeing a greater whole. I'm also taking myself out of the box where I always have to be right and judging myself. So, ironically, when I surrender, I get a greater sense of safety.
Mary, we have 5 minutes. I'm mourning the fact that we only have 5 minutes and want to be able to cover intuition, but especially gratitude and trust, because I think they're so important.
Let me say something quickly about each of them.
Right.
When we want to rely on intuition, which is nonlinear knowing, we have to let go a little bit of our need for facts and experts and the idea that we already know in order to listen to our felt sense, our real inner guidance. And when we set aside the attachment to facts and information, not permanently, but temporarily, we can allow that inner knowing to be felt and heard. With gratitude, we have to let go of our always craving for more in order to look at what's around us already in our lives and take it up again with renewed delight, the delight we felt in it when it was new in our lives. And when we do that, we gain peacefulness. We let go of the craving and we gain peacefulness. Trust is the quality of being that permeates all the others. In a sense, trust is letting go of our need to understand everything, our need to figure everything out. And when we do that, we get freedom. So these last three qualities of being are really a subtle inner movement to trusting the sacred, to trusting the mystery, which permeates all of the qualities of being. That no matter what the circumstance looks like, there's a larger picture. There's more at work than what we see. And we can turn our attention to that larger picture with optimism and hopefulness and take action from that point of view. If we do that, we can really empower our future so much more than if we stay stuck in the dark.
Well, I tell you, this has been a fantastic show. I'm sure we'll have lots of response to it. And I want to make sure that people know how they can either get a hold of you, get the book, any information you would like to put out, please do so.
Thank you, Bella. I have a website, and they can order the book through the website or get it at their local bookstore. The website is www.revmary.com. So it's easy to find and easy to remember. There's a lot of information on the website, including my schedule, a nourishing thought for the day, ongoing newsletters, and so on. So I encourage people to find it and get on the email list for that.
Now that's RevMary, RevMary.com.
Yes, that is correct. I am traveling a lot, but I also am in Northern California, and they can reach me at 707-874-1141. So the website is probably the best, but there's also the phone number.
Okay, can you give that one more time?
Yes, 707-874-1141.
And this book, for any of you who missed the title, Guidance from the Darkness, The Transforming Power of the Divine Feminine in Difficult Times. This has been the Reverend Mary Murray Shelton. I thank you beyond words for your contribution to the show today. And
thank you so much, Bella. It's been my pleasure.
Thank you. This is Bella Johnson. You've been listening to Alternative Currents, heard the first Friday of every month at 10 a.m. I look forward to talking with you again on a subject as yet to be disclosed in November. Thank you for listening. And thanks to Joel Mann for engineering.